Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of Metastatic Urothelial Bladder Cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Scott Tagawa from the Weill Cornell Medicine New York Presbyterian Meyer Cancer Center in New York City. In addition to this interview program, there's also a corresponding video featuring Dr. Tagawa's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him to discuss how he strategizes the sequencing of therapies of patients with metastatic disease.
For someone with metastatic disease that's untreated, the first question still remains cisplatin eligibility. Age is not an official criteria in what many people refer to as the Galsky criteria, because Matt Galsky was the first author on that main publication. But everything goes with age. So renal function, for instance, we do a calculated clearance. Age is part of that. So it does go in. And then clearly there are 90-year-olds that can handle cisplatin, but most, even if they don't meet any of the criteria, is not necessarily the best thing. But the reason that remains is because cisplatin chemotherapy combinations in a subset has, by itself, this is pre-IO, pre-anything else, led to some durable responses. Those tend to be those that can, number one, handle the combinations, obviously, and those that have soft tissue only disease, you know, mostly lymph node only, but there's some that have lung only that might help. So that remains the first assessment for everyone. And then generally it doesn't really matter if it's cis versus carbo, then generally followed by avelumab maintenance. That would be the kind of the level one data. If they have disease control for that 15-20% that have primary progression, and that primary progression is probably higher with carbo than it is with cis, partly because of the inferiority of the drug. There's not level one data, but there's a Twitter discussion right now on that, right? But we believe that to be true. But it's also the patients that we choose to give carbo versus cis. You know, there's other things that go into it. So the primary progression rate on platinum-based chemotherapy might be a little bit higher with carbo. The concept is still generally IO next, but then it would be second-line chemotherapy, and then that level one data would be PD-1 with platinum as true second-line. But the concept is generally platinum followed by IO. You know, Atezo withdrew, but there still is a label for non-cisplatin candidates who are PD-L1 high for pembrolizumab. And then there's the overall label for non-chemo candidates, meaning not carbo or cis. You know, there are some patients that maybe I'd consider that, but generally speaking, I would say platinum-based chemotherapy, whether it's cis or carbo, followed by avelumab maintenance. To me, I think we do better for the overall population than, you know, selecting those that are going to get carbo and looking at PD-L1. That's what I believe overall, but there's some that are, you know, not really great candidates for any chemotherapy or refuse. Those that I think are good candidates and refuse, that's just depends on how much time I spend talking to them, as I generally find. But so platinum-based chemotherapy followed by IO is really the standard. And then I would generally say, you know, not that we have head-to-head data, but we have one drug that has level one evidence, you know, based on randomized trials with an overall survival benefit, and that's enfortumab vedotin. So I'd say that remains the standard of care in that second/third line setting post platinum and IO, if nothing else, at least based on level of evidence. And then, you know, we'll see what happens after that. There are patients where I might deviate. So, you know, there's, say someone has an activating FGFR3 mutation and, you know, had a bunch of long-term IVs and wants to get something oral. You know, I'll say that this doesn't have the level of evidence, but you know, that might go into it. Someone that walks in the door or can't walk in the door that well because of neuropathy. You know, maybe I'll bypass EV and go with sacituzumab govitecan. So there are times that I might deviate from that general pathway. But clearly EV is active and has level one evidence. So I'd say that is the kind of gold standard in that post-platinum IO population.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about some cases and how this plays out in your practice.
Yeah, this is a gentleman. He's a retired detective that at age 79, you know, a very healthy, functional age 79, had gross hematuria, workup, revealed urothelial carcinoma, upper tract, and he had a right nephroureterectomy and was disease-free for a couple of years, but then on surveillance, developed both lung as well as lymph node metastasis, biopsy proven. He happened to enroll in one of the combination cohorts of the EV-103 trial. So not surprising at then at age 81 was not a cisplatin candidate, but was healthy overall. So got triple therapy with carbo EV plus pembrolizumab, developed some toxicity to the cytotoxics. So stopped those and continued pembro maintenance. I should, you know, going back to the content, that's kind of built into the EV pembro regimen, that the way that that's written in is if there's toxicity to one, you can continue the other. So someone develops IR AEs that makes us stop the pembro, EV continue, but most of the time it's the opposite. So it kind of has cytotoxic chemo combination, chemo IO or cytotoxic IO combination followed by IO maintenance kind of built into that regimen. But anyway, that's what we did with him. He was on total for about 10 months and then had progression. Not surprisingly, and I'm saying this because he had upper tract. So upper tract is more enriched for this luminal genomics that tends to be FGFR3 driven. So I say that not surprisingly because he had upper tract. He had an FGFR3 activating mutation and went under erdafitinib. He actually, during this, I don't think related to any treatment, just because he's older and I'm following him, actually developed two separate second primaries, so melanoma as well as CLL. But anyway, it was held and then restarted. He tolerated it, and then we had some dose adjustments with erdafitinib, but eventually progressed. And then 6 months after the erdafitinib, started as sacituzumab govitecan. He actually just progressed on that, but you know, he did well. He started off on 10 milligrams per kilograms. We did titrate down to 7.5. He tolerated that for, you know, basically a year and a half. It finally started to progress. So, you know, I think this illustrates that, you know, we have different lines of therapies with different targets. You know, patients can, number one, respond to these subsequent therapies, and then number two, can also tolerate them, because he's now 85.
So a lot there. It's a great case to just go over the whole thing, so to speak. So first, going into the initial approach to his metastatic disease, I see that he did have lung and lymph node mets. Was he symptomatic from the mets?
He was well, not specifically on, you know, kind of specific questioning, maybe had a little bit of fatigue, but this was found on a surveillance scan.
Any role for, not necessarily in him, but in general, or maybe with him, for particularly in older patients, expectant observation, or did the diagnosis of metastatic disease means they need to be treated?
No, absolutely. I remember a very specific case as a fellow. She came in, I saw, you know, lung mets. They were, I think it was like two or three small. And then he brought up the scan from like 8 years before, and they were bigger, but not that much bigger. So very clearly there is a role. You know, part of the issue in the past, we had less available therapy. We now have more, so including immunotherapy. So, you know, we maybe do that a little bit less, but, you know, someone with minimally or asymptomatic disease, especially with a longer disease-free interval, you know, at the minimum, it's not wrong to do, you know, at least do one more scan. Generally speaking, I would say the best candidate for the, with one organ involved, we'd say this one is two. And then also not just one or two lung mets, he had multiple. So in any case, and he also wanted to be treated. So there are patients that just want to be treated, but it's part of the discussion, particularly in those that look like they may have indolent disease.
You were mentioning in your talk the issue of eligibility for platinum. How do you determine it yourself? What's your individual approach? I know you'd individualize it based on patients. And how did you see this patient in that regard?
Well, he went on a trial, so he used the official criteria. Renal function is really the number one. You know, it in the criteria, it's 60 is the cutoff. But it really, to me, depends on the setting. And I think the individualizing is the word. So it's individualizing based on the patient and individualizing based on the goal. So when the goal is cure, such as someone who's in the metastatic setting and might lymph node only, or in the perioperative setting with muscle invasive, we know that we can fractionate the cisplatin, you know, give half on day one, day two, or half on day one, day eight, with extra fluids, et cetera. So, you know, and actually prospective phase three taxpayer trials, meaning NCTN trials, the CLDB 90601, which was gem-cis with bevacizumab placebo, which was a negative trial, but that actually allowed patients to come in with a calculated clearance of 50. If they were between 50 and 60, you fractionated the cisplatin. If they were above 60, you gave single. So even phase threes have done that. You know, I will sometimes go into the 40s in the more curative, younger, healthier patient setting. So yes, absolutely individualizing it. And there's some patients that have a calculated clearance of 70, but have a poor performance status or other issues where I'm not gonna push it, particularly when I'm not thinking of a curative setting. You know, there's some issues. You know, most of us, I don't think, do a lot of audiograms because, you know, I think that's a lot related to age. And if I think that cisplatin is a good drug otherwise, you know, we'll caution them, but, you know, we won't always do that. But when we want to make someone officially cisplatin eligible, sometimes we do the audiogram if we need a true criteria, particularly if they're older.
Interesting. I like your terminology of taxpayer research or funded research. I'm kind of curious, and, you know, I bring this up a lot of times because for people who are kind of new to oncology, any kind of global thought, and this goes beyond GU, but like right now, what the percent of clinical research that's being reported in journals and meetings is, you know, taxpayer or non-industry as opposed to industry, and how you that compares to, let's say, 10 years ago?
So I don't know the proportion. My guess is the proportion is actually lower because my viewpoint is there are many more pharma companies out there that are handling their own drugs. They used to develop and then turn them over to CTEP, which is, you know, which is the group that distributes for the NCI. So that early phase drug development is much more held in-house with pharma than it is, or sometimes academic institutions, as well as the available amount of funding hasn't gone up that proportionally to inflation, for instance. So it is a lower percentage overall, although I can't quote you any specific data. You know, I do think we are able to ask questions that I think are of interest to patients and physicians that may not be as of interest to pharmaceutical companies. So I think that, you know, having both strategies are nice to have.
Yeah, I agree. Getting back to the management of patients with metastatic disease, using this patient as an example, one other topic I'm just kind of curious about is your approach to oligometastatic disease and whether or not you use local therapy in that situation, either upfront or during treatment.
So, you know, for symptomatic disease, especially when it's symptomatic disease that we worried that something bad might happen, such as, you know, a T-spine metastasis that's causing a lot of pain, that's, you know, cord compression, obviously, but even that something that's encroaching or something that's like that, we'll certainly look at local therapy first. So, you know, surgery if possible, if it is actually true cord compression, or more likely radiation or ablation or something like that if it's not. So anyway, symptomatic management is I think always going to be part of oncology. You know, maybe if the more powerful systemic regimens we have, maybe we do that less, because, you know, for instance, how often do we need to do that when it's lymphoma, testis cancer, even prostate cancer, when the systemic therapy is so effective, and some, you know, sometimes within hours or days. So it kind of does depend on, you know, what we have in our pocket for systemic therapy. But I think there's always going to be a place for local therapy. In terms of, you know, oligometastatic disease and only local therapy, you know, we in the GU world, you know, we have patients with testis cancer. We've also had patients with, you know, historically, I'm just going back, renal cell carcinoma, where there wasn't really good systemic options. Metastectomy has always been part of what we do, either kind of as consolidation in the world of germ cell tumors, or as the only therapy for renal cell. And that it has also translated to urothelial as well, you know, solitary lung metastasis, resection or ablation, lymph node metastasis, et cetera. So, you know, that can have a play, just to kind of dovetail a little bit. And this is what I'm going to say next, is not only for oligometastatic disease, but, you know, I think many people are familiar with the concept of using immunotherapy, specifically immune checkpoint inhibitors, with radiation. It looks pretty convincing in mice. I'm not sure how convincing that absolutely is in humans. So there is a current trial led by the Alliance that is essentially patients on label for kind of second line immune checkpoint inhibitors, or in that non-chemo eligible, you know, setting, where it is immune checkpoint inhibitor alone or immune checkpoint inhibitor plus radiation, where we're looking to prove that will work or not. But that's just another example. So, and I know that people just do that without the randomized data. Where I think that has real justification is in the setting where we're going to be giving immunotherapy and there happens to be a very symptomatic area, so we'll radiate at the same time.
So this patient went on trial, and we'll talk about that in a second, but I'm curious what you think your likely therapy would be today for a patient in this situation outside of a trial. I guess assuming that you knew, I don't know if you knew in the beginning that it was FGFR positive, but let's just assume that. How would you approach first-line therapy in this man?
I probably would have given him carboplatin and gemcitabine first. He probably would have had some disease control, meaning I would have followed that with avelumab maintenance. You know, the interesting thing about the FGFR, and I don't recall if we knew prior to starting or if we knew during. We probably knew prior to starting. But, you know, there is some data which is not clear cut, but there's some data that points towards that luminal subtype, which is enriched for FGFR3, having it's the quote immune desert setting where there's a low response. And actually, the confirmatory trial for erdafitinib called THOR, which is if they're post platinum and IO naive, they're randomized pembro versus erdafitinib in that group. If they're post both, then it's versus second line chemo. So, you know, there's a thought that some of us have that maybe we'd bypass the immunotherapy, but because that is retrospective, you know, I will say I would have probably given gem carbo followed by maintenance of avelumab and then seeing what happened. And then, you know, today, if there was progression, then EV probably would have been, it probably would have been this order afterwards, EV, erdafitinib, and SG.
Right. In terms of the trial, first of all, it sounds like he did well symptomatically on the trial. No major toxicities, no autoimmune issues.
He developed a borderline autoimmune issue. It was not entirely clear. He had a potential nerve issue, but also carpal tunnel. So that was not clear, but he did develop neuropathy. So that's where the carbo and EV stopped and he continued pembro.
Right. And this general strategy of combining an IO with an antibody drug conjugate, to me, I've always been fascinated, always, and hadn't been out there that long, particularly about all the excitement you all have about enfortumab and pembro. You know, one of the things, you know, that I thought about, and I'm sure everybody else is, you know, this is the dominant strategy in lung cancers, chemo plus IO first line. I mean, I look at antibody drug conjugates as sort of like chemo. So the strategy makes a lot of sense. You were also mentioning that a similar strategy is being looked at with sacituzumab. How do you compare indirectly what we've seen so far with both antibody drug conjugates being combined with chemo? I know with sacituzumab, it's not first line, but I'm just kind of curious how it looks to you.
So I'm going to make a statement. So in that that lung cancer strategy of combining with platinum-based chemotherapy does not work. So multiple trials are all negative, whether it is combining with PD-1, with PD-L1, or PD-1 plus CTLA-4. So we haven't figured out the reason, but the combinations with true kind of plain cytotoxic chemotherapy haven't worked. Sequential works, whether it's second line or maintenance. So haven't figured out why, because a lot of us relate, you know, urothelial cancer, you know, we say it's similar to non-small cell lung cancer, smoking, et cetera, high tumor mutational burden, et cetera. But for whatever reason, that strategy didn't work. It looks like it does work. So now to answer your question, so I'd say that it does look like the response rates with the ADC plus PD-1 doublets look to be higher than we'd expect with either one alone. So that's why I'd say the statement. I'd say that comparing across clinical trials, EV has a higher overall response rate than SG, and then so does the combo. So that's why I would look at both of them. What I really like about the EV Pembro one, you know, like I said when I was showing the slides, is that spider plot with the tail of the curve, and that's what we really want, is for them to maybe even stop therapy, right? Because in almost all trials with Pembro, it's a max of 2 years. So they hit there, they stop, and they have the opportunity to come back on if they have progression, but many don't need to come back on. So we don't know how many that's going to be, because it's still, even though there's longer-term follow-up, we don't have true long-term follow-up. But, you know, that's what we had with cisplatin, that approximately 10% that were trial eligible. That's not the whole real world. So, but that were trial eligible, tend to be soft tissue only, they never necessarily needed anything else. So, you know, it is, that's what I'm hopeful for. And that's why, you know, we don't have the randomized data yet, but that's why many of us, I think, are so bullish on these combinations.
Yeah, that's a really good point about the other trials that you were mentioning with just regular chemo plus IO. If it does turn out that somehow by using an antibody drug conjugate with an IO maybe would work better than, you know, using chemo plus IO, if that turns to be the case, why do you think it would be?
So I don't know, but I have two main hypotheses. So one is that there's the antibody itself. So some of these antibodies have effect on their own, including immune via ADCC. So that might be something that's there. The other is that maybe we're, you know, the concept of an ADC is to deliver more potent drugs. So maybe we are able to, you know, generate more neoantigen exposure by bringing in more potent cytotoxics than we can, you know, with that. SG is different. But, you know, when we look at EV, for instance, versus platinum-based chemotherapy, especially carboplatin, there's less myelosuppression. Now, that's peripheral myelosuppression. We don't know what's going on in the tissue, but that's another theory that's out there. I'm not sure how much that plays into it, but maybe because obviously it works in lung cancer, but are we suppressing the immune system with the, you know, with some of these other cytotoxic agents?
Another issue with this case that you brought up is the fact that he was diagnosed with melanoma and CLL. During this time, I assume he didn't need treatment for those?
Only surgical resection for the melanoma and nothing for the CLL. Actually, I guess it's more of an SLL, because it was, he had, during a period of time, it was kind of when he was off erdafitinib and come back on, he had lymph node growth. And we weren't sure, was it melanoma? Was it urothelial? and it turned out to be SLL. So that just happened to, that just occurred. Yep.
I mean, I guess even if he needed to be treated, at least for CLL, probably, I don't know that BTK inhibitors or venetoclax would have anything to do with his urothelial cancer. If the melanoma needed to be treated and needed an IO, that might be kind of interesting in terms of how that would intersect with his bladder cancer, but fortunately they weren't issues.
We debated adjuvant, but I ultimately advised him against, because it really developed the melanoma on Pembro. So.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's a good point, right? So in any event, I don't know if he was BRAF positive, was he?
I don't remember the melanoma part, but I don't think so, because we didn't
have that might have given him a different option. Yeah. So he gets through chemo and EV through the trial, and now is coming up on, for most patients, would be third line therapy. But he's got an FGFR alteration. And he got erdafitinib and then SG. Is that, do you ever do reverse that sequence?
Yeah, neither one should lead to resistance for the other one. My natural instinct when we have a target and we have a drug is to go with the targeted therapy, unless there's data, there's, you know, true clinical sequencing data that says we're going to do one versus, you know, first versus the other. So anyway, that kind of happened. And, you know, as I mentioned before, he wanted to go on something that was not intravenous. So that was the other part that happened.
So speaking of having a target, I'm finding myself getting a little confused, particularly over the past year, in terms of antibody drug conjugates and targets. Of course, we saw with HER2, you know, HER2 low patients responding in breast cancer to an antibody drug conjugate, trastuzumab deratuxan. And there's even discussion in breast cancer about whether or not people would respond to HER2 zero, but so that was one thing that sort of made me rethink the whole idea of antibody drug conjugates. But also that we're seeing antibody drug conjugates that are being approved and used where not everybody has, quote, the target. So, you know, in terms of enfortumab and sacituzumab, can you comment a little bit about sort of what the relationship is between the target, the amount of target and benefit? And also now we're hearing more about bystander effect. So I'm not sure if you're picking up on the whole kind of thing from our perspective out here in the real world, but it's kind of getting a little bit, at least confusing in my head, in terms of exactly how targeted antibody drug conjugates are.
So I think there's multiple aspects that are there, but if we just think about the target, you know, part of that is within a certain disease, how prevalent is it? So as it turns out, TROP2 is virtually always there in urothelial, as is Nectin-4. There may be I'm sure there is a minority of patients, because we know that, but is that 5%? We don't actually know what that is. It's a very small percentage that have low or no expression. So, you know, that's one. Versus if you look at HER2, because HER2 is an attractive target actually in urothelial, depending on what cutoff we use, you know, maybe it's a quarter, something like that. So I think for urothelial, I think we'd want to select for that. So I think part of it is dependent on the target. In terms of, you know, beyond that, I think a lot of it is dependent on the ADC. So SG, for instance, the hydrolyzable linker is designed to release the SN38, you know, not only in the cells, but in the stroma. So that is designed to have, you know, bystander effect. There actually is a trial in combination with IO, I think it was with Nevo, of TDXD in urothelial carcinoma. That linker is also designed to release and get into that's my explanation for why, not necessarily in stroma, but at least diffuse out, why, you know, the HER2 low is, works with that particular drug, but not necessarily with other HER2 ADCs. So that's not the target. I think that's more the construct of the ADC.
Yeah, when you were talking about SG, I had not heard that. I mean, we just were at the San Antonio meeting. We were talking about SG a lot, and I had never heard anybody go through what you went through. Can you go through it again? And you just sort of alluded to it, but why SG is sort of made differently, how it's different from other antibody drug conjugates?
Yeah, so I wouldn't say it's 100% unique, but it goes against what ADCs are supposed to be. So ADCs are supposed to be very specific. You put on, in a very tight manner, the most potent toxin you can find, and then you target those cells and kill them. And you're able to do that because it's very targeted. You know, that's the kind of the concept that is there. And you know, it kind of depends on what the goal is. So David Goldberg created this and had this concept of, we're going to have this ADC where they chose a linker. SN38 we know works, but they chose a warhead that works, is stronger than we like to give systemically, but you know it's going to be safe if it releases, and then develop this hydrolyzable linker that allows it to release. The other part that I didn't talk about is what people call about the DAR, the drug antibody ratio. It's very high. It's approximately 7.6, where, you know, for the stronger ones, it tends to be 2 to 3, something that's like that. So, you know, that whole construct has led to success. That's all I can say. That's the for sure truth, because it works in randomized trials in triple negative and ER positive breast cancer. We know that. That's the randomized data that we have. We'll see what happens with urothelial. But the concept is just a little bit different.
Right. I think you commented a little bit on it, but can you talk a little bit about what happened to him when he was on erdafitinib, how you dealt with his phosphate levels and any kind of side effects he had?
So he was actually up titrated, which means that in the first 2 to 3 weeks, his phosphorus didn't go up that much, and he also didn't develop other adverse events. I don't remember the order. I know that he went from 9 to 8. I don't remember if that was before or after holding it for the surgery. In theory, there can be wound healing effects with blocking of FGFR. We don't actually know that as much. So anyway, that was the rationale for holding it then. Plus, I don't remember. No, he probably wasn't really NPO for that long. But in any case, we held it and then we restarted. So I don't remember the timing, but he definitely went from 9 to 8, and ultimately he went from 8 to 6. And that was more for skin toxicity. So he still has, has actually some neuropathy, and then developed hand foot. It wasn't in my mind that bad. I've seen worse. But it really affected his feet more, I think, because he had the combination of neuropathy plus some hand foot. We ended up going from 8 to 6. We can go lower, but his longer term dose was 6.
So from a quality of life point of view, what fraction of people who get erdafitinib in this situation sort of cruise through quality? Maybe you're adjusting their dose and all, but you ask them and they say, hey, that was really no problem.
It's the minority if we look at kind of the entire course. So getting through the first couple of months, even whether it's going up or not, is not everyone, but it's not uncommon. But it does happen over time. And you know, the tolerance, I'm using the tolerance, but I'm gonna just use a different word because I can't think of a good word. Once they've had a response, and especially once they've hit their maximum response, that same amount of even grade 1 toxicity may not be as worth it as when we're trying to achieve the response. So that combination that is there, you know, the phosphorus tends to not be an issue after the kidney regulates itself after the first couple of months. Not that it can't happen, but is, you know, much less common then. Other things can kind of, you know, come in later, although most happen really within the initial period of time, whether it's, you know, the common ones, I think, you know, aside from phosphorus, are going to be mucositis. So sometimes that's terrible, or sometimes just taste alteration, which is annoying. But, you know, when it's really mucositis, I will say no, you're not allowed to continue. You need to go down. Taste alteration, I leave it up to them. You know, how much is it affecting their quality of life? Rash, similar. You know, even grade three, you know, that's just body surface area. They don't necessarily have to be symptomatic. So depending on how bad it is, I might continue that. But if it's really bothering them, it's on their face, you know, whatever it is, then we may adjust that. The nails disfiguring a little bit, but sometimes they're very painful. So that, you know, those are the main ones that lead to dose adjustments. The eye toxicity is, I think, just scary for the patients to hear about, scary maybe for the doctors that haven't prescribed it before, but it is in the minority. It's about a quarter. So there was a presentation, I can't remember if it was ASCO or ESMO, on the overall longer-term toxicity as well as management of toxicities on that trial. And that's coming out in print, well, probably online first and then in print. So there'll be some guidance that is there. But the longer-term resolution, so three-fourths of that minority that developed eye toxicity resolved. So it's not something that, so it happens in the minority, it resolves fully in the majority that do get it.
You know, you're mentioning people who haven't used it. You know, I feel like we talk about five lines of approved therapy. It's a poster child for, you know, great developments in oncology. But there are a lot of general medical oncology, right? Like you say, have not used erdafitinib. And there's quite a few have very little experience with antibody drug conjugates as well. For the patient who's getting enfortumab alone, unlike this patient who was on the trial, but just enfortumab alone, again, roughly, and I mean, these are not scientific numbers, it's more your clinical experience, what fraction of them, at least from their point of view, quality of life point of view, don't really have much of a problem at all, as opposed to having some kind of problem that interferes with quality of life? And is that, what is that usually, rash, diarrhea, or I mean, rash, peripheral neuropathy, what is it usually?
Yeah, so the rash, you know, grade one is the most common grade for that to occur. And that, you know, I think is largely based on location. Although some patients with, you know, 1 centimeter thing, it's really bothersome, and others that their entire body could be desquamating and doesn't bother them. But anyway, that would be one of the more common ones that is more of an annoyance, but doesn't affect quality of life, you know, that much. You know, sometimes it's itchy, but usually it doesn't. But again, can be severe, including Stevens-Johnson's and death in a very small minority. So we need to watch them. The neuropathy is something that, even though it's usually also grade one, you know, that can affect quality of life. You know, it adds up over time. If it takes them 5 minutes to button their button instead of 1 minute, you know, it adds up over time. And I think most patients will trade that for responding cancer. But, you know, over time, again, it can be annoying. And, you know, we use in research these definitions of grade all the time. If someone looks up the definition of grade 2 sensory neuropathy and what are the criteria, one of them is inability to use a phone. So that's going to affect quality of life. And, you know, I think that is old-fashioned phones. So I think that is maybe even worse, you know, with smartphones.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I'm kind of curious, have you seen Stevens-Johnson in anybody, your patients there with EV?
I have not. I've seen close, where we've been worried enough about that might happen that we have admitted to the hospital, but I have not seen true Stevens-Johnson's.
Yeah, I don't think you'd have to see too many of those to feel concern, but if you haven't seen it, I guess, you can look at the numbers too, but it's also encouraging that you haven't seen
it. Yeah, it can be frightening because it's obvious a visual thing, you know, for the patient, sometimes actually more for the family than the patient. And then, you know, for the doctor and nurse who hasn't seen that before, because it can be, you know, a majority of the body surface area. And, you know, those are the ones we really want to watch. Most often they're fine with dose holds. You know, no mucosal involvement. It's, you know, 40-50% of the body surface area. Most of the time they're fine with dose holds, but some people get nervous. It's okay to give some steroids if you want, but most are fine with dose holds. And just starting back at the same dose, a lot of times they're okay. The more severe it is, dose hold with or without other supportive care, and then restarting at a lower dose.
Again, in terms of sacituzumab, quality of life issues, what are the common things that come up? And also, how do you deal with cytopenias, which we hear a lot about in breast cancer?
So, yeah, I mean, cytopenias are the most common high-grade adverse event with the drug across, different tumor types. I would say on average, the average patient with advanced urothelial carcinoma probably has more febrile neutropenia risks than the average patient with metastatic breast cancer. And maybe that's why the febrile neutropenia rate looks higher, you know, at least numerically in some of the urothelial studies than it does, same in prostate actually, than it does with breast cancer. That being said, you know, if we look at guidelines, you know, guidelines there for a reason, you know, it doesn't hit a, it does actually come close to a 17 or 20% febrile neutropenia rate. And we are talking about a non-curative setting, at least on label. So I don't tend to use a lot of growth factor. I more dose reduce. I know that is not necessarily true when I talk to my breast cancer colleagues. They're used to using growth factor. So in any case, the cytopenias are more, I think, something that we're dealing with as the practitioners, not something that changes so much the patient's, you know, quality of life, although some of them will worry about it. You know, something that we worry about, and you know, this is not unique. We have, you know, the world of oncology is, you know, mostly been poisons that lead to, you know, patients think of hair loss and vomiting. We think of myelosuppression, and we know how to do that either with growth factor or adjustments in terms of the dose. So that's out there. What I should mention, it was on one slide, but I haven't mentioned it. So it's not as important as irinotecan just because of the way it's delivered and glucuronidation in the liver. But when someone does have a homozygote for a UGT1A1 polymorphism, there is more myelosuppression with this drug. There might be trends for diarrhea that's not entirely clear because there just haven't been so many, but clearly there is more neutropenia, which then could lead to more febrile neutropenia. So it's not in the label that one needs to screen, but if someone you know has that or has in the family, or you notice, hey, I see this intermittent bilirubinemia, and look like, or they have a known history of Gilbert's, which is associated with the polymorphism, then, you know, we either really want to watch them closely or even start off with a dose reduction. But it doesn't happen, you know, that often, but it is something to keep an eye out for. Going back to answer your question, so diarrhea tends to be what can affect the quality of life. Fortunately, it tends to be short-lived related to the doses, meaning happening for 1, 2, or 3 days, kind of related to each dose, not the entire cycle. And then, you know, it tends to happen around the same time with every patient. Some patients only after day 8, you know, there's buildup. Sometimes it's, you know, day 2 after every dose. There's a fraction that it lasts a long time, and those are the ones that get grade 3 because it goes from grade 1 to grade 2 to grade 3. So anyway, I make sure that, you know, everyone, you know, has antidiarrheal. Usually I'll start with over the counter. And then if I need to, you know, prescribe, you know, atropine or something, then that's only when the over-the-counters don't working. I'm not pre-medicating with atropine like some might do with irinotecan. That might happen at some point in time if there's a specific patient, but that generally that is not something that's necessary.
That's really interesting about the Gilbert's. Would that apply to something like TDXD?
No, it shouldn't. That's a different, but I don't know that 100%. So I don't think it should. But it's, you know, it's all going to be dependent on the metabolism of the drug. So not to my knowledge, but I don't know that for sure.
Speaking of TDXD, and you were mentioning, I've always been curious about the high incidence. To me, high, you know, 25% is higher than breast cancer, HER2 positivity. What's going on in that space in general with anti-HER therapy and also antibody drug conjugates?
So there's been activity over years, you know, starting with trastuzumab, some alone and in combination with chemotherapy. Phase twos didn't really go that far. There actually was a phase three HER2 immune drug adjuvantly that turned out not to work. Partly was the way it was, the way we selected the patients, but partly the I think the drug didn't work that well. So it's been there for a while. There are several different ADCs, including those that are already used in other diseases, plus one that was initially developed in urothelial carcinoma that actually has breakthrough designation with the FDA. It's called dasatinib vedotin. The initial data published in last year by the Chinese group looks very interesting. It looks like higher response rates in those with 2+ or 3+ or amplified, but you know some responses in 1+. My issue with that is that it's MMAE. So I can give EV to anyone. I would have to select for HER2. So they probably already received EV at that point, unless they had some issue like pre-existing skin issues where they want to give the drug or something like that, because they both have neuropathy. So I'm worried about sequential MMAE and the effect on the nerves actually with that. But anyway, in answer to your question, there's a number of different HER2-targeted ADCs that are in development.
So I wanted to just ask you briefly about a couple more of your cases. First, this 85-year-old woman, just to get a more of a feel for what happened when she went on erdafitinib, what happened with her?
So she luckily responded, as you can see here. She also developed toxicity. She might have been the one with the most toxicity that I was really playing around with her doses, you know, off label. So, what I was doing with her was, intermittent dosing, meaning 4 days in a row, 3 days off, at the lowest dose. And then sometimes, even because she would have a certain number of pills, as we were prescribing the other ones, we'd say, okay, take just the four or take just the three. So we were playing around with her dosing. Her toxicity was, well, she had mouth toxicity as well as skin and nails. But it was really her hands, her skin and nails that became the issue.
You know, older people have visual issues and she had cataracts. So how did that play out when considering she was also an erdafitinib?
No issues. So in the real world, things don't happen the same way as happen, in clinical trials, where I would say we did it at baseline and I'd say you need the 1 month, you need the 2 month, you need the 3 month. And she didn't want to come to us. She had her own local ophthalmologist where I'd say go and she would not. But anyway, with issues, she had intermittent eye issues before, didn't change. But anyway, it was when she actually made it to ophthalmologists, it wasn't CSR, which is true. You know, I skipped over it. When you look at the New England Journal publication, or if you look at this updated publication, we're going to look at it, the number of eye issues is half. It's like half the patients or more will have some sort of eye issues that may not even be related, just have eye issues, where CSR is maybe up to a quarter. So yes, of course, people have eye issues. And, I didn't mention that. So there's no real eye issues with SG. There's a very small minority that might have some eye issues with EV, but not that common. There's other ADCs that might have more eye issues. So, working more closely with our eye colleagues, whether that is ophthalmologists or optometrists, I think it's just something that is coming more into play as a necessity in oncology.
Yeah, been talking a lot about that in myeloma because they have an antibody drug conjugate, belantamab, that causes ophthalmic issues. That actually just got pulled off the market probably temporarily. But in any event, those patients have the same thing. They have to go to an ophthalmologist. They don't want to go, et cetera. it's a similar challenge clinically. Why don't we finish out with the last patient you have, the 66-year-old patient who's the neck. Yeah, there you go. What happened there?
So, you know, when I pulled it, I didn't realize these were all upper tract. These all happen to be upper tract. So for those of you out there, urothelial cancer most often happens actually in the bladder. I guess these were there partly because these are illustrations of at least the first and last of receiving multiple doses. But anyway, upper tract, whether these are because of drop metastasis or the field effect, not uncommonly, we see that there's actually bladder cancer that evolved. Developed multifocal lymph node metastasis, biopsy proven, FGFR3 alteration. Got GemCis. He's someone I talked to because he had, number one, a near CR, and number two, this FGFR, where I said, you know, some retrospective data, maybe you don't respond as well, but we decided to proceed with Avella maintenance. And then despite that, he developed bone metastasis as well as, you know, he had the other sites of disease. So he started erdafitinib next. He actually initially was able to go up and then down, and then he also went down to six, progressed, and then got EV, happened to get denosumab, so, you know, progressed in lymph node plus bone, also was having some neuropathy, so he enrolled in that phase three SG trial, was randomized to SG. And unfortunately, like with the other ones, had responded, but was short-lived, and then progressed, and he's now in a phase one trial.
How did he do on the SG?
He responded. He had soft tissue response, stable bones, but then progressed in lymph node.
Side effect wise. Yeah.
It was fine. Actually, out of all of the systemic therapy, although I don't remember if I asked him about avelumab. So ignoring avelumab, he liked it better than GemCis, than erdafitinib, and EV.
That's always a good measure of things. I love those patient preferences trials. Any ongoing trials? Of course, you mentioned the EV plus Pembro trial. Any other trials that are maturing right now that we should have our eyes open for?
So the EV Pembro one is the one that really, I think, could change the landscape. There is a trial, also a cooperative group trial, looking at eribulin. It's early. It's not enrolling that quickly, I think, in part because there's a lot of other choices. It's eribulin versus best available agents, you know, generally is after all these drugs. It may incorporate SG into the control arm, which I then think would make it a little bit more palatable to doctors and patients. But anyway, that's another phase three that is out there, you know, based on some interesting early phase data. Actually, it's been out there for a long time through the California Cancer Consortium. So that looks interesting. There's another one that looks interesting, this FA drug in combination with pembrolizumab that was presented at ESMO last year, I think. That combination, especially in selected patients, looks to have a much higher response rate than we expect with historical control. So that's early phase data, but was enough to lead through breakthrough designation. So that looks interesting. You know, as I mentioned, there's a bunch of other ADCs that are in development. I think many of us in this disease, as well as other diseases, are looking for immunotherapy that might work post kind of standard immune checkpoint inhibitors. There's nothing that I would identify that looks incredibly promising. You know, there's maybe some very early phase data with TIGIT and other things, but, you know, that's I think where a lot of us are interested, because even if it's a minority, you know, it's about 1 in 5, maybe a little bit higher, but we're talking about 20-30% that we respond to pembrolizumab, for instance, but it can be durable. So, you know, we're looking for something that will have a, you know, opportunity for a durable response.
I don't know if it's just because we came back from the ASH meeting, but I always like to ask solid tumor people what's new in terms of CAR T or bispecifics.
So less active in urothelial than some other solid tumors. I would say what's obvious, because we have two approved ADCs. So obviously targeting cell surface targets is a successful paradigm. You know, I'd say optimally for either a bispecific or especially a CAR T, we'd like something that's a little bit more selective. So there's, you know, there's on target off tumor toxicity. That's the skin toxicity with EV, because Nectin-4 has high expression in skin. So I'd say that's not the only part of it, but one of the major barriers of development of CAR Ts in solid tumors is the lack of that more selective. Or, you know, we look at CD19, something that you can safely ablate and you can just give them antibodies if you need it, you know, for a period of time. So, you know, that's one of the issues. There's also, you know, differences in tolerance and, you know, some of the neuro effects, I'd say, broadly speaking, with especially CAR Ts, but maybe with bispecifics are a little bit different in solid tumors than heme malignancies.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Tagawa, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.